say, Anine, bonjour, hello, and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. It's a subject many only whisper about or avoid altogether, our period. But for many Indigenous people, this is a sacred time to reflect, renew, and to honor the feminine.
Grandmother Moon, she is connected to all feminine energy, all women across Turtle Island.
Grandmother Moon is central to many Indigenous teachings around menstruation. Lenape and Anishinaabe elder Tracy Whiteye says that's because of the moon's powerful influence.
Every 28 days, we'll get our moon time. And that's when your grandmothers come to sit with you. It's like a renewal, revitalization.
Nicole White is changing the conversation around moon time cycles and providing menstrual products to empower the next generation.
We can create space to feel empowered to ask questions, create space that doesn't have that shame-infused content and language that you're choosing. There's some really powerful work that we can do.
Plus, in Hoopa territory, the flower dance has returned after a 150-year absence. Kutcher Risling Baldy tells us how it only took one generation to change apprehension into celebration.
The world has changed now. We've changed the entire world for everybody because now you can't grow up in a way of thinking that you don't celebrate women at this time in their lives.
Today, Indigenous women who are leading a return of celebration and education around menstruation. Aunt Flo, Shark Week, that time of the month. There's lots of euphemisms for being on your period, but for many Indigenous people, this time is known as moon time. Tracy Whiteye is a Lenape and Anishinaabe grandmother from the Delaware Nation of the Thames. She's here to share these moon time teachings with us. Tracy, welcome to Unreserved.
Ah, bonjour. Wabas kisko ni kan kaya tabit. Nishnakaz Makododam Dunjaba Lenape Nation Nelly Lenape Nishnabe Kwayan Dao. What I said in my language is my spirit name means white bear, polar bear woman who's looking ahead. My father is the one originally from the Lenape Nation. He's Turtle Clan. And my mom is Niashingaming from the Niashingaming territory. And because we're matriarchy, we follow our mother's clan system. So that's where the bear clan, my Dodam, Mako Dodam. So I come from the waters of my mom, my grandma, my great grandma, and all of the waters. And that's the intergenerational wisdom that I carry within all of my being, my DNA, and who I am.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with me. Tracy, can you tell us why is menstruation known as a woman's moon time in many Indigenous nations?
Because it's part of our connection to Nokomistibikisis, Grandmother Moon. Grandmother Moon is our original grandma that's connected to all feminine energy, all women across Turtle Island. She regulates our menstrual cycles. She regulates the waters of our Mother Earth, the rivers, the lakes, the oceans, the brooks. She regulates the waters that we carry within ourselves. Our mother, our Nokomistibikisis, is all part of that connection and our regulation of our menstrual cycles, in which we call moon time. And how she does that is through the moon cycles every 28 days. And what I was taught by my grandmas, by my teachers, that's when your grandmothers come to sit with you. They sit with you, they help you regulate and cleanse. It's a woman's young girl going into womanhood, opportunity to release and let go some of those things that maybe she picked up in the last 28 days. It's like a renewal, revitalization.
And also a very sacred time, as I understand it. What happens during that 28-day ceremony cycle when we honor the moon and our moon time?
If we want to go right back to when the young girl walks into womanhood, it's a passage. That young girl will take for an example, whole year off, 13 moons, and she calls it her berry fast. And so during that whole year, that young girl sits with those aunties. She goes to water ceremonies, understands how water is life. She gains the understanding of every 28 days and why it's important that we go to the fire, and those circle of women from all over our relatives. And it's not just the grandma that's pouring the water or conducting, it's all of the women gathering together in circle that's teaching that young woman about moon time, about womanhood, about motherhood, about relationships.
And so I just love that image of women gathering around a fire every full moon to share these teachings with the younger, person who's going through this transition. You mentioned the berry fast. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that is?
So that is about a young girl when she first gets her moon time, when she first starts her menstrual cycle. It's like we celebrate. Welcome to womanhood. So she gets to stand in a different stage of life. She could be just walking out of her fast life into wondering and wandering. So that's the best time to sit with them and reach them. And so then we prepare them. We, as aunties and grandmas and relatives, will watch her as she grows. She could be a good sower. She could be a gardener. She may know the medicines, so many things. And plus, she learns a different part of her spirit name. And because of colonization and all of those things that have interfered with part of our identity, that could be the time where she gets her spirit name, or she gets introduced to her clan, her identity. It's really a sense of belonging to I belong. This is who I am. And so through that whole time, they get a nice little feast bundle. So when she has her moon time, she has a plate, a cup, a bowl, her utensils. The one girl that I'm working with, everything's strawberries. So when she starts her time, she would bring that out. So family knew she was on her time. She was celebrating that her menstrual cycle, her grandmother's visiting her. So then we would take care of her and we'd cook for her. We'd make sure she rested. When her time comes and her grandma visits, that's the time to rejuvenate. That's the time where she sits quietly and just listens to the messages, honors who she is.
And part of that berry fast is literally you have to not eat berries for that year. Why is that a significant part of it?
Because that strawberry, that old daemon, that heart berry is the leader of all berries, the leader of the blueberries, the raspberries, the thimbleberries, all of those connections of those, that's the leader of the family. When you look at a strawberry, it teaches us vulnerability. The seeds are on the outside, but also you look at the berry, it's the shape of a heart. It's about understanding emotional and heart intelligence. That's so connected to our indigenous intelligence. So when they do that whole year of berry fasting, no berries, no connection to that berry fa fasting, it teaches them about themselves. It teaches them commitment, because they say, in the many ceremonies that I've been part of in my own healing journey, when you first get taste that berry, after that first, after your berry fast, it just awakens every cell, every part of that woman to remind her that's who she is. Berries are medicine, and it also shows them too that they are medicine too.
I love that. Such a beautiful celebration of womanhood, of honoring self, of self-care, of making those connections with other women in your community and in your circle. When was this interrupted? When did we, as you know, Indigenous people and Indigenous women, get separated from the moon?
You know, to my understanding, because I can only speak through my understanding, it started back when Duncan Campbell Scott quoted taking the Indian out of the child in the residential school systems. My grandma Philomene Ba was a very fluent Anishinaabe Mohan speaker. And it was when my mom was displaced from the community, from Neoshingaming, and put into the mush hole. That's where it was disrupted.
Yeah.
And so when I'm out there doing this, doing the work and helping as that helper, as that Skabe Kwe, where those women never got those teachings, where they're 40, 50, 60 years old. And the one lady was 72. She got to do her berry fast because she was part of the 60 Skupe. And it was her granddaughter that led the way. She stepped out and said, hey, I want to do my berry fast. And I want my mom and grandma to be my supporter. So they came and sat in the circle, the one circle I was facilitating. And then all of a sudden, that grandma goes, can I talk to you at the end? I said, sure. You know, so I knew that was in confidence. And she said, I want to do this. I never was given this. I was scooped up from my home, from my family. And I got lost in society, not knowing who I was. And here I am. There's my granddaughter leading the way. I want to do this with her. Can I? Absolutely. And so she did that with her daughter, her granddaughter. So these kind of things, you know, we can, that whole breaking cycles and that introduction of that sense of belonging and who they are, to be seen, to be heard, and all the beauty of those spiritual needs, eh? And it is the opportunity for that inner child healing for that grandma.
Beautiful. You mentioned Duncan C. Scott earlier, former Indian agent for Canada, who brought in the residential school system, of course, with the aim of killing the Indian and the child. Of course, now we're seeing that was failure, utterly complete failure.
We're still here.
We're still here. We're still brown and we're still Indigenous. Why is it important? Why is it important to learn these things again and to pass them on to the next generation?
Because every day when I take that breath of life in the morning and giving my thanks and offering, you know, my gratitude, it's when I see my grandchildren, because that's my future. And that's what keeps me going. You know, it's seeing those little ones making those changes, picking up their language, wanting to know their way of life, wanting to know who they are. Even those youth, oh my gosh, how they speak and stand in their lights. And it's that you see that movement, that beautiful energy just spark. And I know all I ever want to do is just encourage and support them. Say, yes, I got your back. Yes, I got your hand. Yes, I'm there to hold you up if you feel that you can't do it. That's so continuing to learn my role as that grandma, as that mom, as that auntie, and as that sister, but mostly important to always become that friend, that best friend to myself.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And finally, you know, menstruation is often seen as gross or taboo or to be hidden or something to be ashamed of. What message do you hope these teachings, you know, send to people who still feel that embarrassment or that awkwardness talking about periods?
You know, I just sit beside them and allow them to express, you know, why you feel like that. I guess being that sounding board, I don't want to be part of that shaming or uncomfort. If anything, I'd want to be part of that support, that lifting, that understanding. And so at times sharing our own story, because I remember my story when I first, because I was a residential school survivor's daughter. And the first time I got my moon time, all I remember is it seemed like this big box of Kotex was bigger than the house I lived in. And it's like, it's like, what do I do with that? So you got to read the box. That self-taught, so having sharing those kind of stories about my own personal feeling and journey kind of breaks the ice with them, eh? They can write, oh, so you went through that too. Absolutely. So I think, sharing our own life experiences really helps them to break down that wall a little bit. Yeah. That's just an example.
I remember those giant boxes of Kotex. It's traumatic memory for me now. Well, thank you for sharing some of your wisdom today, and for teaching us a little bit about, the sacred time in our lives.
Oh, you're welcome. No problem. It was a great honor.
Namaskar.
Okay, Mama P.
Tracy Whiteye is a Lenape and Anishinaabe grandmother and educator from the Delaware Nation of the Thames. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, how Indigenous women are removing the shame and replacing it with the celebration of menstruation, or moon time. Later in the show, we head to Hoopa territory, where one community has brought back the flower dance. Kutcher Risling Baldy says her ancestors preserved cultural knowledge so that when it came time to dance again, they would all be ready.
Native people that were doing these interviews or these discussions with like white male ethnographers and anthropologists in the 1800s, they weren't doing that because they were really concerned that that guy needed to get tenure. They were creating an archive for us. They were like, someday they're going to come find us again, and we're going to need to give them all of these pieces. And they're living through a genocide, and they're still thinking about the future. And I think that's so important, because they're like, I can't remember everything. I can't write and say everything, but I can remember this. I can remember this song. I can remember this moment. I can tell you about this thing. And that to me is such a beautiful thing about what we're putting back together, because it came from so many spaces.
More about the return of the flower dance coming up. Taking us there, a song about remembering your own strength. Desiree Dorian is a proud member of the Opaskwayak Cree Nation, Manitoba. The country singer's seventh studio album, Remember Your Name, was released earlier this year. She says the title track is a song about resilience, finding your inner strength and leaning on that with every fiber of your being.
You scream out loud, but you have no voice. You had a dream, now you have a choice. Remember.
Desiree Dorian with Remember Your Name. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. When Nicole White started her moon time, she never had to worry about being able to find tampons or pads. She also knew what to expect from menstruation because her mother was a nurse who told her what the experience would be like. And so it came as a surprise when she learned that others are raised with very different experiences. For example, she learned that in some schools in northern Saskatchewan, children were missing school due to a lack of access to menstrual products. So she decided to take action. Nicole is the founder of Moontime Connections, an organization that has delivered over 10 million menstrual products to northern and remote communities across Turtle Island since 2017. Nicole, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Take me to the moment when you realized that menstruation was having some really negative impacts on young people.
Yeah, it actually came about as a result of reading a CBC story that said that young people in northern Saskatchewan were missing school because they didn't have access to products. And sometimes issues seem so complex, but this one seemed like there was a very tangible piece that we could meet. So I put out a call to my community, and just a few short weeks later, we had a big community drive going on that sent nearly 100,000 products up north.
Amazing. What made you want to do something about that situation?
Well, I've worked in community. I've worked supporting folks who had mental health addiction and were unhoused and, you know, really seeing a need and realizing that I had capacity to create change in my own community. I knew I could do something, and thankfully the community agreed with me.
What was the issue? Why were they going without these products?
For sure. You know, I think I come from a great amount of privilege. I live here in Treaty 6 territory in Saskatoon, and I can just walk down the block to get product. And in some communities, access is a real issue. And if you are navigating poverty, they are very much considered a luxury product for many families.
That might surprise people in the South to think that, you know, pads and tampons and things that all women at some point will need, many go without. Does that surprise you that there are people surprised?
You know, it surprised me when we started doing some of the research to find the major access issues. You know, so many smaller communities don't even have stores. If you have a community that just has ice roads or they're fly-in only, do they have stores? And if you go into the store, is it even there? So, yeah, there was issues of access that I for sure needed to do some learning around for sure.
And if they are there, how much are they?
Right? They're
right.
Three or four times what I'm paying here in a small city like Saskatoon.
Yeah. In fact, there is a term for that. It's called period poverty. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So it's really recognizing that there is major inequity when it comes to access for product. And we've come to understand that people should have product when they need it. It should be as readily available as toilet paper. So we want to really do what we can to meet people where they're at and have menstrual products readily available when that moment strikes.
Yeah. We mentioned that, you know, Moontime Connections has delivered over 10 million products. Paint me a picture of how high the need is for these resources. Where were you sending them?
So we started with sending products to 7 communities in northern Saskatchewan, and we've expanded. We support nearly 200 communities across northern and remote Turtle Island as of today.
Wow, that is an immense number. How have you seen, you know, the demand change since you began this work?
So when we started, we really focused on single-use products. So single-use products being tampons and pads. And in recent years, we've been really lucky to have funding partners to provide reusable products. So we are one of the few menstrual equity organizations that provides a full spectrum of products. So that includes single-use tampons, pads, cloth pads, period underwear, and discs and cups. Body autonomy is super important to us, and we know that menstruation is a very personal journey. Mm-hmm. So giving people the opportunity of choice is really important to us.
And how does it work? Do you just send a bulk to schools or to the northern store? Like how are people accessing?
Yeah, we started mostly just supporting schools. And since then, we've expanded to include elementary schools, high schools. Sometimes it's women's shelters, friendship centers, health clinics, midwifery organizations. We really want to meet people where they're at in community.
How personal is this work for you? I mean, not everybody is going to go out there and try to change the world in this seemingly small way, but really a huge way. Why are you doing it? What is the personal pay for you?
Gosh, it's been such a deeply powerful and healing opportunity. I had been working within inner city Saskatoon before, and we frequently did food hampers for families who are impacted by HIV/AIDS in the past. And there was always a small group of female academics I shoulder tapped at Christmas time, and I called them my tampon fairies because nobody ever thought to be donating menstrual products 15 years ago. So I knew that there was a need there. I guess when I think of my personal impact, it's honestly, I never knew how powerful it was to be a part of an incredible community of giving, an incredible community of support. But on top of that, with our work within the education training we started doing in the last few years, that is a piece that empowers Northern partners to go through facilitator training so they could talk about menstruation and moon time. Mm. And it also creates space to bring in elders, to create space to translate those materials into traditional languages, sometimes for the first time ever, finding language for words that we're bringing back into community. I think that personal healing piece, I didn't even realize I needed, but yeah. I'm profoundly thankful to have walked this journey with our leads across the country.
Well, what was your own personal experience, you know, preparing for menstruation as a young person?
Yeah, so you said in the intro, my mom was an RN, so she came from a very clinical perspective. There was a text with transparencies for, you know, muscles and different body parts. And she also gave me like a top 10 questions that teens ask Dear Abby. So I definitely came in with good information, but I was a late bloomer. I didn't get my period until I was in ninth grade, and I was a little jealous and excited about that experience.
Same, girl. Same.
Nice.
Can you tell me about when you first got your period?
Gosh, yeah. It was the night of the Christmas dance, and I was wearing a white dress, and I had never had my period before, but because I was wearing this white dress, I ended up putting a pad in, and it was that night that it happened. So I was very thankful to be proactive and preventative for that. And so, yeah, that's how my first experience happened.
Wow. It's so fortunate that you didn't have to do the sweater around the waist business.
That came later, for sure. That for sure came later.
You know, talking about, you know, moon times is very uncomfortable for a lot of us. I'm sure there are men right now cringing that I said the word period on the radio. Why do you think that is?
I am so thankful you mentioned that. And I think there is an incredibly important role for our men, for our partners, for our dads, and for our brothers in this work. Because my traditional teachings is that men are supposed to have like a support role. They're supposed to take up and create space for that renewal process for the person in their life who's menstruating. So I think we've got a lot of work to do when it comes to creating space for men to be comfortable with this. I pride myself in pushing people through that discomfort sometimes. Maybe not pushing isn't a word, but creating space to talk about it and destigmatizing the subject of menstruation and moon time is such an important thing to do. If we can create space for the next generation to feel empowered to ask questions, create space that doesn't have that shame-infused content and language that you're choosing, there's some really powerful work that we can do. I was doing a presentation in Ontario to Métis elders, and an elder came up to me afterwards, and she actually said, you know, I understand the role of the berry fast, the role that I can take to sort of support young people and reclaiming some of these traditions. But she also had a moment of learning. She was like, I think I need to think about the language I use when it comes to our young people and how I talk about moon time. So it's not always negative. It was really wonderful moment for me to hear that what we're doing supports people of all generations in doing that work and sometimes some unlearning.
Yeah. When you say you're trying to create space and help, you know, people through the uncomfortableness of this conversation, how are you doing that?
Well, I had mentioned we've got the Moontime Facilitator training people can do. And when we got the funding, we actually asked our community partners, what do you want this education to look like? And the community told us, here's what we want modules around. So we built modules for 6 to 12, 12 to 18, 18 and up. And then if you're a parent or caregiver of a young person who menstruates, then you've got tools and resources to facilitate those workshops in your community. Alongside that, we have created space to bring in elders, bring in that space to talk about the traditional teachings and talk about the medicines, whether it's cedar on the West Coast or the berry fast in the prairies or whatever it is from coast to coast to coast, to reclaim those pieces, that rite of passage that has been lost over the years.
How do you see that making a difference, you know, with young, you know, young girls who are, you know, starting their menses? Do you see a shift in how they see that and how they see themselves?
I think we've got a long ways to go. I think we're at the beginning of this conversation, but I'm really excited to hear how this could impact, you know, a young person now who's starting their period, and how do they parent and talk to their child about it as a result of the deeper work they've done within community and learning. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll ever be able to capture some of the full ripple effects of our work, and that's really that intergenerational those changes. I'm really excited to see how things evolve through the years.
Yeah. What about in your own family? Do you have these conversations, you know, with your daughters?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I've only got one daughter and she just turned 7, but she's very familiar. We listen, pads are perfect building block toys that do not hurt anyone. And so she's definitely been surrounded by menstrual products since she's been on Earth's side. So she definitely knows what blood looks like. She's seen mommy, you know, change products. And so she has that awareness that she's not scared of it. And she definitely knows that this change might be coming for her in the future.
Mm. What do you think the world could look like, you know, who support our women, our two spirits, our trans, our non-binary folks around their moon times? What does that look ideally for you?
I really want to thank you for asking that question. You know, internally within our organization, we originally started as Moontime Sisters, and we realized quite quickly that was exclusionary language. So we actually, I went into ceremony with elders and came out with a new name. So Moontime Connections is what we transitioned to a few years ago to really include and honor our two-spirit trans and non-binary menstruators. So what that support looks like, is there some great health clinics that do gender-affirming care in northern communities. So we specifically send particular product for those menstruators. So usually boxer briefs are more appropriate for those folks who may be on the gender spectrum, and really honoring that there is a whole other round of different teachings for our two-spirit and trans and non-binary folks. So creating space for that. I think Moontime Connections have been doing some deeper work with elders and creating some videos and resources that can be supported in that learning.
Wonderful. Amazing. Thank you, Nicole, so much for your time today.
Thank you, Rosanna.
And for the great work that you're doing.
I appreciate your time today.
Nicole White is Métis from Treaty 6 territory. She lives in Saskatoon and is the founder of Moontime Connections. One of the instruments used in hoopa ceremony is the flower dance stick. Its gentle taps help those within a flower dance ceremony connect to the earth and find balance. The song you're hearing now is performed by Viola Chummy Brooks and Kutcher Risling Baldy. They're part of a cultural resurgence in hoopa territory, one that celebrates young people in their community as they start their menstruation. The flower dance was once practiced openly by the hoopa, but it was dormant for nearly 150 years. until a group of women called for its return. Cutter Risling Baldy has since been part of revitalizing the flower dance, and she documented the story of its return to her community. Kutcha, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about the flower dance. How do the Hoopa people celebrate someone's first menstruation?
Our coming of age ceremony is really a public ceremony where we come together to sing and dance over a young person as they are coming of age. We generally do this at the onset of a first menstruation. It's a way to help this young person move into a new phase of their life. And so they spend 3, 5, 7, or 10 days doing multiple kinds of tasks and learning about ceremonial practices, learning from people in their communities, seeing the support that they have in their lives. And then at night, we come together and we sing and we dance and we celebrate them until the last day when we dance all night long to show them just how much community support they have. And then in the morning, we watch as they come out and sing their own song. And we see them as like the powerful person that they've become because we've been able to come together as a community with them.
That's beautiful. And what does the dancer learn through all of this, you know, the ceremony?
They learn so much. I think what it is it's a marking of the transition that you go through as you're moving in these phases of your life. And to say that these are important things that you're experiencing. And so we know that puberty and adolescence is such an important time in someone's development. And this is a moment where we say, okay, we want to make sure you know that you're going to be okay and that you have tools that you can use as you're moving through your life. And so they learn a lot, not just about cultural practices, where they learn about how to take care of themselves through herbs or steams, or how we would make sure that people had a good understanding of the world around them. They also learn about physical care. They learn about mental health care. We have talking circles with women in the community to talk about some of the things that they've been through and what they learned. They're able to request things that they would like to be taught. So we've had young people request, like learning how to braid hair really well, or learning about basket weaving, learning about their family tree. It is really just the time to focus in on showing them that there's a whole community around them that can be there to help them along the way, but also that they have like their own strength and power to navigate anything that's happening throughout their lives.
Mm, that's amazing. How did you learn about the flower dance?
When I was 12, I started my period. I started menstruating, and my mom actually took me out to dinner to celebrate. And at that dinner, she told me that we would have done a dance for me if it had been sort of before colonization, that it would have been like a tremendous way of showing just how powerful I am as a young person. And she offered, even though we hadn't done the dance in probably like 150 years, to try to find a way to put it back together and do it for me. And at the time I was 12, I had just gone through the experience of learning about menstruation in school. I had internalized that it was something that you shouldn't talk about, that it was dirty or that something was wrong with me. And so I was like, no, I don't want anybody to ever know that this happened to me. So I turned her down. I think after that, what I recognize is that there was ways that people started talking about it in our communities just on the regular. They were trying to find ways to get more people interested in it. And my mom especially was very adamant that like our young women really needed ceremonies that helped them to understand their role and place in culture and society because we were surrounded by like a Western patriarchal culture. And so they just kept bringing it up. And I look back now at moments where our elders would show up at the local schools and they would do demonstrations of this dance, or they would talk about it, or where they would do public talks and they would insist that we also learn flower dance songs, even though we weren't really doing or singing flower dance songs at the time. So I feel like our elders did a great job at reminding us that this dance was there for us and that it was always going to be there, and that it was, that the dance was waiting for us to sort of be ready for it. And it took a long time, but then we finally had a young woman who we were able to speak with and talk to about it. And she agreed that she would try to do it. And it was sort of our first time. There were so many things that I think went wrong, so many things that went right. But we just watched as all of these young women stepped forward after that. And now now we have so many that we are so overscheduled in the summer months because we have so many young women that want to do this dance.
Mm. The dance is waiting for you. I love that. That's beautiful. Why wasn't this ceremony being practiced in your culture previous to the revitalization?
So much had to do with the violence that happened during colonization, especially during the gold rush in our area. So we live in very far northern California. What they say about us is we were, you know, quote, relatively late in the colonization cycle. We didn't really have the establishment of the mission system or sort of what was happening on the East Coast of the United States. And what we really see is a massive influx of people during the gold rush. And really all they're interested in is how they can destroy all things Native peoples, the land itself, the animals. They overhunt, they cut down all of the trees. It's a very violent period of time. And during that period of time, where we would have been celebrating young women as they start menstruating, you also see a real focus on the violence against women that happens, and they really go after, especially young women. And what you see at this time is they establish a law that allows them to enslave Native people under an apprenticeship law, is what they call it. And the people who are mostly enslaved under this law in our area, which is Humboldt County, are young girls, ages 7 to 12. And so you see that they're very much targeting young girls. They get the most money for them when they're trying to sell them into this enslavement system. You saw settlers at that time targeting that, especially as moments where they were going to come and really commit violence against the people in those dances. It had to go underground. We had to protect our young women. I always say to people, we didn't lose it. And I don't like the language where people say, oh, did you lose your culture because of it? I was like, we didn't lose anything. It was violently wrested away from us by colonization.
Mm-hmm. And what was the effect of, you know, having to hide that ceremony, having that ripped away from you? What was the results of that for your young women?
I mean, I think you see an unbalancing of the world. And so what we say in our area is that we are world renewal peoples. The work that we do in ceremony is to balance the world, to put it into balance, to make sure that it doesn't fall out of balance. And part of that balance is this flower dance ceremony, this ceremony for celebrating menstruation. And it's one of our high ceremonies. It's one of our key ceremonies. It's one of the ceremonies that we say are done for all time in the heavens above. So it's being done right now to keep the world together. And when we need it, we call it down to us and we say, this is what we want to, this is what we need to use right now. And then when we're done, we send it back. And when you saw the severing of that moment, what you see is an internalization amongst peoples that somehow we are a patriarchal culture, or that we don't value women and their roles in our culture. And you didn't see women stepping forward as much post-colonization. And yet that would not have been how we operated or organized our own like political systems or social systems. So then you started to see a real sort of devaluing of women in spaces, and then it becomes internalized, and then we start to apply it in our own settings. And I think this is something that my mother talked to us a lot about, like, we can't operate under patriarchy and have our young women grow up believing that they aren't important. And she was like, we have to empower women under this system that we are currently under. And part of that dance is to make sure that everybody knows that it's our job to help women to feel empowered in that. And I think that that's something that we really thought about as we were bringing this dance back.
Why was it important for your mom to start doing this work and continue to do the work?
I think part of what happened is that I grew up with a very powerful set of women in my life. I had medicine women in my life. I had people who were, you know, leaders. And yet I still internalized this idea that somehow I was second best, that my value came from how men like viewed me and the way in which a patriarchal culture viewed me. And so as I grew up, she was sort of watching that happen. And we had this moment where I was in a very violent relationship at the time, and I wasn't talking about it with anyone. I wasn't telling anybody what was happening. And after a really horrible incident between us, I called her. I called her on the phone and I said, "Mom, I think I'm going to leave him." And she like said, "You're making the right decision." And I like paused and I was like, "No, Mom, he's right. I am nothing and I'll be nothing without him." And she like took a moment, and I remember this so clearly. She said to me on the phone, she goes, "Katja, we should have danced for you." And she went to the women at that point and she was like, "What are we doing? Like, our girls think that they are nothing. How are they growing up believing that they are nothing? We have to do something." And she was like, "And that's what we're going to do. We're going to do this dance. Because when you dance for somebody, when you sing for them, when you stop the world for 5, 7, or 10 days for them, they cannot grow up in a world thinking that they are nothing, because they know that the whole world will stop to celebrate them, and the whole world will stop to show them how important they are. And then they will turn around and do that for the next girl and the next girl." And I think that community is what we're building as part of this dance for young women.
Mm. And so how did you start to, you know, relearn those steps, if you will? You know, how did you start to build back the culture?
I think a lot of it was something bigger than us. I think it was always part of like our elders' cultural imagination. It's why they talked about it all the time. Even though it wasn't something we were doing, they would still mention it to so many people. We recognized at one point we were trying to figure out songs because we didn't have a lot of songs when we first started. And so we were going into the archives and we were listening to songs that people had sang. And we were trying to find them again. And then and then my mom was actually sharing a song. She was like, "Oh, I have this one song," which then we realized was a song that her grandfather and then her mother had sang to like her and then me as a lullaby. But it was actually a flower dance song. And what the medicine woman from my tribe who I talked to talks about is all it really took was us saying that we wanted it. Then everything will come to you, because the dance itself is like, oh, they're ready. So now we have to send all of the things that they need. And suddenly what happened is like elders started having dreams that they were like, "Oh, I forgot when I was little that my mom told me these things or said this stuff." Or people started finding things like in their garages that like their parents had left behind. Or we were in the archives and I would randomly pick out a folder and it would be like a whole interview with somebody just about this dance. And I was like, oh, they were always leaving things for us. They were always like, someday they're going to need this. And this is why I often tell Native people, like Native people that were doing these interviews or these discussions with like white male ethnographers and anthropologists in the 1800s, they weren't doing that because they were really concerned that that guy needed to get tenure, right? They were doing that for us. They were creating an archive for us. They were like, someday they're going to come find us again and we're going to need to give them all of these pieces. And they're living through a genocide and they're still thinking about the future. And that to me is such a beautiful thing about what we're putting back together, because it came from so many spaces. We sing a song in the flower dance quite often. That is a song that a woman actually recorded and left behind with an ethnographer, and she said to him, like, someday they're going to need this again so they can sing it in a flower dance. And then we do. So I feel like to remember that they were building the future, that we are the future that they were building, I think is really powerful.
It is very powerful. You've said that, you know, it's been just, what, 24 years,
yeah,
since this dance has come back. And now you're saying it's commonplace, more flower dancers than ever before. How did it rewriting, you know, the shame around menstruation that is still quite, you know, pervasive in society?
I think it does a lot. I mean, I have so many stories of young women in our community that get very excited when they start menstruating now. And I mean, when they hear other narratives around them where people are like, no, actually, it's something kind of like shameful or bad. They are like, no, you're wrong. It doesn't even register as like they have to fight about it. They're just like, no, you're wrong. And then they kind of move on because they've seen a very physical manifestation of people celebrating and being excited. I have noticed a change in how men and young men and our elders really approach young girls, where they celebrate, they get very excited for them as they think about these moments in their lives. We've had young women show up at my parents' house because they want to start planning their dance after they start menstruating, and telling my father, who's like in his 70s, I've started my period, and he goes, congratulations, you get to be a flower dance girl. Like, it's just a very standard way of talking, which I think is important to normalize, that this is actually how we should be thinking about women in our cultures and societies.
Mm. You mentioned that your daughter had her flower dance. As you watched your daughter go through the ceremony and, you know, sing the songs, dance the dance, being accepted and taught and uplifted by, you know, her community, did you reflect on your own decision to not dance? And how did you reflect on that?
I mean, I think a lot of us women, especially the ones who grew up in sort of my generation or earlier, it wasn't something that we were able to do. But I do think that as we've been able to help more and more young women to do them, there's a healing that happens no matter what in that space. There's moments that happen no matter what where we start to really see the strength and power that we've carried with us our whole lives. And we might make decisions sometimes that we're like, oh no, did I make the wrong? Maybe, but that's the beautiful thing about what we do in ceremony is you are learning that you can make decisions and that sometimes those decisions might not work out and that you're going to be okay, because behind you and around you is a whole community of people that will say, how can I help or how can I uplift you? And that to me is so important. So when I reflect on like my own life experience, I think about like all the things we had to go through to get to these moments. And that I feel really good about the fact that we kept going and that our elders, our ancestors kept going, and that they were like, look at this, in the midst of the worst periods of time, in the midst of, you know, genocide and boarding schools and sterilization and termination, all these things, we know that we will come out the other side with a world that we can put back into balance, and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it, and all of our future generations are going to do it. And it may not look exactly like what we thought, but it's going to be something important. And I remind myself of that constantly, especially now. When we show up for this girl and we sing and dance for her, we're changing the world. We're putting the world back into balance. And that's pretty good for human beings to be able to do.
Thank you so much for your time and your knowledge today.
Thank you.
Dr. Kutcher Risling-Baldy is an associate professor of Native American Studies at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt. She is Hoopa, Karuk, and Yurok, and enrolled in the Hoopa Valley Tribe. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, and Amanda Gear. Shout out to the Native Women's Collective for sharing one of their flower dance songs with us. You can now listen to Unreserved streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty One territory. Gidin Eskimit Nawa. Agusei.